So it's important sometimes to look back in time. I've been working on invasive species since 1989, so a few years, right? And there's a lot of trends that have popped up amongst all of the poster children, if you will, that I've worked with and others have worked with. And sometimes it's good just to look back and think about it, ruminate a bit, and see if there's some common threads that could be useful for all the new invasive species that seem to crop up, such that people working on those don't make the same mistakes that were made on all of the other species. So here's just some common issues that I'm going to talk about that have led to the prominence of invasive species that created some of our famous poster children in the United States and North America, as well as around the world. I mean, one is just not knowing whether it's native or not, and what the native range might be. Also, are there vectors that are involved in its spread that might be unintentional, like horticulturists, for instance? And is there a sympatry sometimes between the introduced ones and the natives that allow for interspecific hybridization and introgression? Is there a long gap time between introduction and the time in which it becomes invasive? Oftentimes due to just kind of a quiet evolution, if you will. So there's three poster children that are kind of the topic for our discussion this morning in my talk, although I'm going to focus predominantly just on the first two. So Lithrum is an emergent wetland invasive species, likes 20 to 30 centimeters of depth of water most. It's insect pollinated. It has self-incompatibility. So growing an isolated genotype by itself might make it look sterile when it's really not, and we'll visit that again in a minute. In the center, we have reed canary grass, and reed canary grass is wind-pollinated. It's a C3 grass. It only grows into 20 centimeters depth of water, whereas Phragmites australis will grow into 30 centimeters of depth. So it has a limit around the edges of waterways as far as how deep it will go. And then, of course, we have submerged aquatics that are invasive, such as Myriophyllum or Eurasian water milfoil. And that one is insect pollinated because the flowers actually emerge above the water level. But otherwise, it's predominantly asexually propagated. So all of these are asexually propagated and or seed propagated. And probably the biggest two from a seed propagation standpoint would be purple loosestrife that can produce up to like 60,000 seeds per plant, and Eurasian water milfoil, which is still a forage and ornamental crop. And we're selling seeds from Roseau, Minnesota, around the globe for reed canary grass. There's been many invasion hypotheses that have been advanced for these three poster children, and if you just follow the color, you can track the major papers in the literature, both from the ecological side or the genetic side, as far as how these may have spread. And a lot of the previous speakers have referred to some of these, such as the enemy release hypothesis, more competitive genotypes, et cetera. So we're just going to look at some of the issues connected with it. And, for instance, on the right, there's just a picture of Lithrum being sold as seedlings. That's in West Virginia. So a little bit about purple loosestrife from a historic standpoint. So the important thing to remember is a lot of these early arriving invasives or exotics, even though there may be natives here as well, there was a long lag time, if you will. You've probably heard of that term before, from its introduction time until suddenly, almost like overnight, it was problematic. And so the case with Lithrum salicaria, Persh was the first one to identify it as being present in North America in 1814. And it basically just sat around. It was spread by horticulturists, beekeepers, et cetera, and I'll show you a map of that in a second. But it really wasn't anything major in any wetland, anywhere, until suddenly in the 1930s, it popped up, and here's a picture from the first big invasive population in a Quebec pasture along a waterway where it took off in 1933. So 120 years after it was first seen on the continent. What happened during that time period? And of course, now it's noxious in almost all of our states. Here's a good example of it in Minnesota. So the distribution, if you look at how this is distributed, in 1880, you can see it's just along things like the Erie Canal, in Hudson Bay, all planted by beekeepers or horticulturists and so forth, you know, that just wondered at the beauty of it and so forth. And it has great ornamental value and is a great source for honey. And so that caused its spread. But it's really not anything significant across the continent. And then if you look in the 1940s, after it became invasive in 33 in Quebec, it suddenly now was spreading very easily along the waterways. And by 1980s or so, you can see how it had spread pretty much across the upper portion of the continent. So there's a lot of historic misconceptions about purple loosestrife. And we worked on it first in 1989. We got a grant from the state of Minnesota to look at it. And specifically, we were looking at the interspecific horticultural cultivars that were on the market. So anything that had the name Morden in front of it, Morden Gleam, Morden Pink, etc., were known interspecific hybrids between Lithrum salicaria and our native winged loosestrife, or Lithrum alatum. All right, so, and those were widely spread by the horticultural trade, and they were always billed as sterile. And so we looked at that to prove or disprove whether or not that was true. Turns out they were all fertile. So as a result, a lot of the assumptions about purple loosestrife were false, simply because of, with the interspecific cultivars, you know, if you only had one cultivar in your yard and there were no insects or native populations around at all, it never set any seed. Or, if you're a good horticulturist and it set seed, you exercise weed control practices, mulching, herbicides, tillage, etc., and you never saw the seedlings. So it's just a matter of, you know, conferring with the industry, which we always have to do, of, like, change your horticultural practices or so forth so that, you know, you don't arrive with all these misconceptions and so forth. And of course, once in the 80s we had all these populations of purple loosestrife, then we introduced an insect for biocontrol to cover it, actually several insects. And of course we tested it on the native ones as well to make sure it wasn't going to kill those because they're, you know, not very well distributed. And as it turns out, everyone had the assumption of all the purple loosestrife populations look the same. Because they kind of do. Really no differences between them. So the assumption in the biocontrol was all of the populations should be able to be controlled by this insect that eats it normally in Europe. And that turned out to be completely false. We saw that across Minnesota, where some populations, complete control, others, partial control, and then a lot of populations where they wouldn't even eat it. So there's a lot of quiet evolution that went on during that lag phase, and that's very important to keep in mind, that all these things, phenotype doesn't tell you that much. I mean, it's good for diagnostic traits, but otherwise, there's a lot of underlying genetics that goes on there that really can be problematic. And so this just kind of illustrates the history from the breeding standpoint, the involvement of horticulturists in this that created these interspecific hybrids that then were one of the mechanisms that allowed for the dramatic spread of purple loosestrife. And, of course, there were additional ones, too, you know, dredging of lakes and streams and so forth and creating marine highways, et cetera. But nonetheless, horticulturists certainly have a lot of blame to deal with. And, of course, we've looked at the introgression of Lithrum alatum into salicaria and found that in the salicaria populations there were all kinds of diagnostic traits only from alatum that were present in salicaria. And so these are just some examples of the traits that we found. Let's move on to reed canary grass. Reed canary grass has a fascinating stories connected with it, which Andre started introducing them to you. I worked with reed canary grass for the past decade or so, and that basically the assumptions have always been by the ecologists as well as the taxonomists that it was Eurasian in origin. Nothing was native to North America. That has since been proven completely false. Intercontinental in distribution in the northern latitudes, and it has spread, of course, rapidly more recently in the evolutionary epoch. But it's still most importantly to remember that it's actually native to both continents. But that makes it difficult because there's really not much of any phenotypic difference between North American natives and European native or Eurasian natives when you go out in the field. So there's no way you can tell them apart. And thus, Andre's work is very important. So Andre already showed you this distribution of reed canary grass, and of course we can point out the fact that Minnesota plays a very important role in the distribution of this species around the globe, and particularly within our continent. So we published many papers on reed canary grass. This is a different paper than the one Andre was talking about. This is an earlier one. This is in Crop Science, where we looked at just the Czech ornamental cultivars and forage cultivars, as well as wild populations in the Czech Republic that we had collected along the rivers, the same manner in how we collected them in Minnesota. And basically the ellipse, the purple ellipse there is most of the horticultural cultivars fell out as being very distinct from the wild Czech populations, with the exception of, where's my arrow here? I'll point instead. With the exception of one right here in the middle of the Czech wild, and that is the only Czech forage cultivar, Hrastava, that is actually just a selection out of the wild. So makes sense that it sits there. And then there are a few other ones that are from an introduction station for where they're using for bioremediation, and those cultivars are distinctly different from everything else. Oh, now my animation didn't work. Oh, well, sorry. Anyway, what's behind this picture is just talking about how the initial discovery of native forms of reed canary grass occurred. And that was by a paper from Lavoie that looked at herbarium specimens in Canada and upstate New York that discovered that most of the herbarium specimens prior to 1825 matched the ornamental cultivar Picta. And then post-1825 up until the early 1900s, they also didn't match anything else compared with the European types. So that was a case that he showed there. And then this graph just shows all the cumulative number of specimens and so forth in the herbaria in Quebec that come from gardens, railroads, and those native ones near rivers and lake shores. Another thing that we've engaged in, we have members of our team that are geologists that look at phytoliths. And so if you have an invasive species, check and see whether or not your species has a unique phytolith. So the one on the lower right-hand corner, the J, is a unique shape of a phytolith just for Phalaris arundinacea. So we have a very unique phytolith, which means that we can go in layers of the sediment in lake beds, and of course we've been doing this in lakes that have wild rice in them and so forth. You can go down and see how far back the phytoliths occur in the geologic time frame. So that's a very important tool, and so that's something that we're going to employ to look at just the historic spread of the native reed canary grass. And then, of course, genetic and molecular evidence initially has been very inconclusive, mainly because it was done by ecologists that didn't understand the horticultural aspects and the forage aspects, and they also weren't geneticists. And so when Kasser's lab came into the spectrum and came out with this big difference between herbarium specimens and European types, we got on board and got some grants and so forth in that realm, and that caused us then to ask some questions about those native ones. And so it was me going up to the forage growers in Roseau, Minnesota, almost 10 years ago, and meeting with them, just talking about what's the history of this. We found out that the city of Roseau and the Roseau River are all named after reeds, all right? So historically, here's the Ojibwe name for that, and that Actually, the Native Americans had used this in weavings for years. And as we looked in the literature, we found all the Native American tribes in the northern latitudes of North America wove with reed canary grass pre-1800. And it's like, most likely then it was native because it was never cultivated as a grass until never got here to North America until the early 1800s by the European immigrants. And so as a result, you know, that gives us additional body of evidence and so forth that indeed these were native to North America. So then we learned as we talked to the growers up there that there's this field, immense field of several hundred acres of it's unplowed, pristine prairie. It has never been touched except for in the Dust Bowl era, as Andre was alluding to, it was mowed, and that hay was then dried and transported throughout the Midwest pre-1940. And we look in the herbaria records, and we see, like in Iowa, for instance, there's almost no herbarium record of reed canary grass pre-1940. And then around that time, suddenly, the number of specimens increases. So it definitely spread from this field throughout the Midwest, and that could very well have been one of the major causes of its spread as an invasive. And this is what that native field looks like. It's still unplowed, and it's still, with the exception of a few trees there, 100% reed canary grass. So basically, the issues of preserving the native forms is something that we're dealing with this. You know, what are the land managers going to do? Is this native or invasive? Do I spray it or not? So we're hoping to come up with a handheld device that will solve that problem for everybody. But the thing I really want to emphasize for everybody is history is important. You need to go talk to people, look at the herbarium specimens, dig in every possible methods and means that you can to find out the past. And if that means coring samples in lake beds or whatever it might be, do it. Because otherwise, you're going to make some of the same mistakes that all the researchers have made with Lithrum, Myriophyllum, and Phalaris. So that's my thoughts on that.
All right, now we want to hear from you. We're officially open for the discussion, open talking, exchanging of ideas. I see you sneaking out. This is where our group wants to hear from you, and we welcome you to the Invasive Plants Research Working Group. Professional Interest Group. Our pig. Welcome to our pig. But we are looking for an exchange of ideas. That was the goal of this workshop. So start talking, folks. What questions do you have for the speakers? What questions do you have for each other? Ideas, observations? Please.
One basic question. Yes. For Neil, how has that field been preserved for all these years?
It's just been kept that way for some unknown reason that I'm not sure actually who owns it, but it's just one of those that sits there and it's nobody ever touched it for some reason. We have no idea why. It's like, thank heavens nobody ever did it.
So it's, we don't know if it's public land?
We don't know yet, yeah. Wow. So we're still trying to find out. So it's bizarre. One of those bizarre things.
That's
so
amazing.
And I also want to say, too, I'm going to hand around a list for all the attendees. Everyone that's here, please sign it with your email address so that we can correspond with you about future workings of this pig.
Yes, it's a good pig. And I the reason I'm sticking the mic in Neil's face is, you know, we are recording this, and we hope to write a paper, workshop papers, about this workshop, so don't be surprised if I come stick the mic in your face when you want to talk. So who's next, now that I've threatened you with the mic?
Hi, my name is Marisa Thompson. I'm in New Mexico as an Extension General Horticulture Specialist. And as I'm talking to people, growers and backyard growers and gardeners, sometimes I'm confronted with where a species that I like and recommend to people in northern New Mexico or southern New Mexico, other people hate it because often of its invasiveness. And I'm thinking of a couple, like I don't know the botanical names, but Russian sage and trumpet vines and There's so many different kinds. And so I just don't know, when I'm teaching and trying to recommend plants for people who say they don't have a green thumb, those are some of the species I would go to first. And then as, even when I'm in when the county office, somebody brought in samples, and she had printouts showing that some of these species that she was really upset with in her garden are on California's do not plant lists. And so, but we're selling them and recommending them, and I just wonder how to deal with that.
Well, from the Florida perspective, we historically have had, our horticulture people have recommended planting certain plants at the same time our weed science group has been giving out recommendations to how to control them. And that actually spurred the development of a system we have in Florida. It's the IFAS assessment of non-native plants. And essentially it's a model that all these species are run through, and university researchers and agents and basically anybody associated with the university has to consult that list before they recommend something. Mm-hmm. So perhaps that would be a good model for your state to build on. Mm-hmm. Anyone else have good suggestions for her on that? Yeah.
We've just added on invasive.org. If you look up a species, we have a map, state map, that tells you if it's on the state invasive list, law, or both. So we're trying to keep that up to date. It's a nice way at one glance to go, all right, across the U.S., who will yell at me if I try planting this? And if it's a law, where will I get arrested if I plant this? So that may at least put the information so you don't have to go hunt down everyone's list. It's compiled, and we're going to try to keep that up to date. University of Georgia, Bugwood. Joe LaForest.
Thank you. Next? Who's next? Yes, sir.
Hi. Wow, that's loud. I'm James Keach from the University of Hawaii. Coming from a plant breeding perspective, not as much experience with invasive species, but one of the things I've heard about anecdotally is when these interspecific hybridization events occur between natives and invasives, there's, you know, a lot of cases. The one that comes to mind is the California native dandelion, where it's kind of getting bred out with the introduced one. But from a plant breeding point of view, do folks know if there's work on trying to kind of seed bank even ones that have some introgression from the invasive species, or how is kind of the management going on to kind of hold, to keep some of these genes, keep some of that germplasm of the natives in the face of some of this invasive and interspecific hybridization?
So essentially, germplasm conservation in the face of outcrossing between natives and introduced?
Yeah.
I'm going to let Neil have that one.
Well, we did a lot of seed bank studies in Lithrum back in the 80s, but that was predominantly for Lithrum salicaria, as far as, you know, the depth at which it survived and its frequency of survival over years. As far as the native one goes, there hasn't been as much research in that regard, although there's been some, but not a lot specifically. And I guess what I would say is I'd point you to a special issue of the journal Euphytica, where that was published in 2016, and I think that was it, or was it 2012? Anyway, it's about invasive species and breeding and selection within plant breeding programs. If you can't find it, email me and I can give you. But that's a whole issue that's connected with all the aspects of, during the breeding and domestication process, what plant breeders can do to potentially select against invasiveness and protect natives and not have new cultivars and so forth become invasive once they get out on the market. So it's kind of a preemptive approach to breeding and development. So I'd give you an encouragement to look at that special issue, because that should have some answers in there for you.
Awesome. Good answer, Neil. Thank you. Who's next? Come on now. It's a workshop, audience participation. Ah, Chris.
I got a question for you, so I'll use the microphone to talk to you from right there. For the water lettuce, what other areas is it being actively managed in the world? Is there data on that?
The short answer is yes, it's being actively managed. As far as records that are kept, not so much. It is one of the world's 100 worst weeds, terrestrial or aquatic, so it is intensively managed virtually everywhere it's been introduced. There is some biocontrol work going on, but it's not super promising at this point. They have a hard time getting the insects to establish. In third world countries that it has invaded, it's typically harvested by hand. But for us, it's prohibitively expensive. It's very labor intensive. And so in Florida and in most of the developed countries where it's managed, where it's allowed, herbicides are the number one go-to for management. So, but yeah, it's a bad problem everywhere. It also harbors, there are a couple different species of mosquitoes that live with it, but there is one in particular that's co-evolved to live on the roots of water lettuce. So it's like really specialized, this Mansonia mosquito. But beyond that, I mean, they're health hazards because they make stagnant water that mosquitoes breed in. And so even small populations need management from that perspective. But yeah, it's bad everywhere.
Another question for you, Lynn, and that has to do with just in thinking of water lettuce and other invasives that are not anchored. So, and with regards to their actual native center of origin and so forth, as well as the spread, has anyone looked at, you know, common issues between water hyacinth, for instance, and water lettuce with regards to potentially native regions and how it might have spread either with the movement of humans through boating and so forth and shipping versus ocean currents? Because I just happen to think that, you know, there's a few studies out there like with coconut seeds and how coconuts floated through the oceans and so forth and how that's been used to document where it actually is native to and how it spread. Has anyone done anything similar with unanchored invasives?
Oh, I'm sorry. So unanchored natives, yeah. The common thread, at least for the floating invasive species in Florida, is they're cultivated for their ornamental characteristics. So most of them are not particularly salt tolerant, so we haven't seen a lot of evidence that they've come in through ocean currents. We have one, not a floating plant, but a rooted one that they suspect was brought in via ballast, but it's not salt tolerant, so it's sort of sketchy. Water lettuce may have been used as dry ballast, so it could have been kind of accidentally transported that way. But the common thread is almost exclusively us. Most of these plants they're very ornamental. I mean, I didn't show pictures of water hyacinths, but if any of you have ever seen water hyacinth, it's a beautiful plant. And I do a lot of extension programming, and I have a talk I call my Dirty Dozen of Florida, and it's actually 13 plants, and 12 of those are plants that were intentionally brought in either via the water garden industry or the aquarium industry and have now escaped cultivation to become highly invasive, and several of those are floating plants. So in addition to water lettuce and water hyacinth, we've got red root floater now, we've got giant salvinia, we've got Azolla pinnata, feathered mosquito fern, and these were brought in intentionally by us. A couple of them were for nitrogen fixation and rice cultivation, but typically it's because they're ornamental. They're pretty. We like them. We want something different from what everybody else has, so we bring them in, and our friends like them, and so since we're such generous gardeners, we share them. So the common thread's us, unfortunately, an intentional introduction.
Just a follow-up note, not to have a discussion between each other here, solely. but you were mentioning ship ballast, and so that's something important to not overlook, too, with any invasives incoming, because we noted that had occurred with purple loosestrife, mm-hmm. that It was dumped by ship ballast coming from a certain place in England that dumped them right there where that 1933 invasive population had occurred. Even though it's not salt tolerant, it had nonetheless somehow quickly washed ashore and then rooted along the edge. Of course, that would be different for your unrooted or unanchored invasives, whatever the term is. So.
Yes, that's very true. And ballast water has been implicated for non-plant species as well. I mean, zebra mussels and quagga mussels and all of these aquatic organisms that are highly invasive. That's like the primary way those are spread is as a result of ballast water. And a lot of the larger ports have regulation now where you have to sterilize your ballast. I mean, you have to dump it out at sea, and then your holds have to be sterilized to make sure that these bad actors aren't getting out and invading these systems. Very big problem in the Great Lakes and in the Pacific Northwest, especially the zebras and quaggas. Fortunately, we don't have those in Florida yet. We end up with everything. I don't think we'll get loose strife, though. We don't get cold enough. Yeah. Yay us. We have everything else. Who's next? We still have a few minutes before we go to our official business meeting. John.
Hi, so John Griffiths, Florida Gulf Coast University, so in the same zone. But I just have a question, and it's back the other way. But as an educator, at a primarily teaching institution, I generally get students coming into horticulture classes as electives, because we don't have that as a major, so I offer them. And I discover something has kind of interestingly happened the reverse direction, and obviously Florida has a lot of information on invasive plants. But I discovered my students have now confused the word invasive and exotic. So everything that's exotic is invasive. And I'm like, okay, let's try this again. So I'm curious, how do people head that off where the best intended invasive information has now become misinformation on plants it doesn't apply to? And I'm constantly doing a rear guard repair on this mistake. So how do we fix from really well-intended trying to stop this to now applying it to things that's not correct?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I have an answer, but I don't want to monopolize this. Do you have an answer? Oh, no. It's like bidding at an auction. You just bought a Rembrandt. So does anybody else want to chime in on that before? Oh, okay. After typical. So typical. No. John, we've had that problem too. Even at UF, the party line is now, if it's not from here, then it's got to be invasive and we have to manage it. And I defy anybody to show me an invasive impatience in South Florida anytime after about March, because they die if you don't water them three times a day. It's hot. The plants are not adapted to South Florida. The terminology is hinky. A lot of people do associate exotic with invasive, and they assume that the natives are good as well. And that's sort of what we're bumping up against, trying to call native plants invasive. There's a lot of blowback. So at least in my program, we're starting to refer to plants as nuisance species, and you know, with no regard for geographically where they came from, because in the water world, if we can't move floodwater during a storm and we have property being flooded, we don't care where those plants are from. They have to be cleared out so we can move the water to prevent that damage to property and wildlife and all that jazz. So the terminology is hinky, and there's a lot of misperceptions. So, and now I'm going to give it to Neil.
Well, one of the things that we've done is to try to find some native that's invasive in your particular area. So what we always use in Minnesota is poison ivy. So, you know, it's native. It's quite lovely, isn't it? No, not really. But it's certainly invasive, and, of course, it causes bad issues. So, and that's an easy way for students to kind of remember that, yeah, natives can be bad, you know. So so that's how we've used it. And then I just wanted to point out, too, that we published a paper a few years ago on auctions with invasive and non-invasive paired species and so forth. And one of the findings in that basically was that every generation of consumers need to be educated. And it's like, you know, as any extension agent does, it's over and over again. You never stop telling them the same story. But the fact is that every generation, for what reason or another, you know, comes up with, you know, misassociating terminology like that. So it's important just to keep hitting it over the head time and again. So,
oh, got another one.
Along those lines, my little sister is, she works with a nonprofit in Seattle that does invasive plant control and working with volunteers, and she has a couple public gardens where she gives classes to sixth graders, and they are immigrant communities, and so she was trying to describe problems with invasive species and exotic species and teach that lesson out in the garden. And one of the students said, what makes a plant invasive? And another student said, we don't like them because they're not from here. And she panicked because she realized that she wishes there was other terms, and so nuisance is interesting. I think she'll like that for talking about what's the problem with a plant that's not from here. And so then she said that she was able to wrap it up by talking about how, in a lot of ways, diversity is healthy for local ecology, and she hopes that that resonated with some of the students, but...
That's a good solution. I mean, and another good example for her for the future, if she needs it, is all of our food virtually is from somewhere else. Yeah. So, oh, yeah, John.
Now, that's often how I approach it, being FGC, so we're surrounded by citrus and tomatoes and peppers. And so when a student says that, I said, so you think those crops are invasive? And you kind of get this look all of a sudden that's like, wait, maybe that's not what I meant. I'm like, okay, so there are ornamentals that fall in that category. They're completely safe and nice to use and attractive, and they're not going anywhere. I usually use the example of bougainvillea. I don't know anywhere where that's invasive, and it's planted all around the world, and it lives a long time, okay, 20, 34 years. But I don't know anywhere where it's a problem. It's no problem in Florida. Do you know? No. I mean, it can be unattractive. It can get away, but I'm just saying, as ornamentals go, it's not going to spread with hundreds of seedlings.
No, it's not
so. Yeah, so, but I just wonder how other people do it, because I that's really kind of the only idea I have, so.
Oh, excellent.
As a breeder, you look at the crops, well, I work with roses and peaches, both exotic, really. You know, they're not from here. And I think the point is that most of the plants we use are exotic. They're from other areas, and that's got to be emphasized. I teach a course in tropical horticulture, and I emphasize that, you know, most of the things we eat are not from here. They're exotic. The ornamentals, a lot of our house plants are tropical. They're not, you know, from North America. And so I think that's probably a very strong way to emphasize that, you know, exotics are not invasive per se. It's the plant itself, it's not where it's from.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, we can't cast a broad net and say that everything that's not from here is automatically bad and everything from here is automatically good. I mean, it's a really good point. So we've got a couple more minutes before we start our business meeting. Three more minutes to be precise. Does anybody else have anything before we have a brief wrap-up? Oh, yeah. Excellent.
One of the speakers talked about there being boundaries that are state boundaries. And with climate change, that's not going to be true anymore. Is there cooperation across state lines to mark things as invasive?
That is an excellent question. I'm going to pass that to our bugwood guy.
Yes. There's a lot of folks that are having the same conversations. They're cooperating in regional groups. It's definitely a topic of who's got what, what's coming in. We've been building a bunch of tools they've specifically requested to say, we're doing it on county basis, but sometimes state. What is within 50 miles, 100 miles of my area, but not currently in my area? So a lot of tools for that. There's been some nice risk prediction tools that Florida's worked on. There's one actually looking at climate change coming out of Massachusetts that EdMaps will be providing the background data for, and they're going to model, as climate were to change, where would you expect it to start showing up? So we can start adding that into what people will see. So definitely a hot topic among the state plant regulatory officials, Departments of Agriculture. I know the land grant people are all talking about it. So it's, if you're interested in that conversation, finding where that is locally for you and being part of that solution is a fun time. We'll help how we can to connect you into those groups.
Is everybody familiar with EdMaps and with the I've Got One app? No.
So for those of you that like using your smartphone, there are regional apps across the U.S. that you can download. So Florida's got I've Got One, and they've been remarkable because they have an advertising campaign, billboards, workshops, everything focused around I've Got One. And it includes everything from pythons in the Everglades to aquatic plants, everything all in one app. All the apps are along those lines. So if you're not in Florida but you're in the Southeast, there's a Southeast Early Detection Network. In the West, there's EdMaps West, which is pretty much the Great Plains over. The Great Lakes Early Detection Network. Get with me, I'll give you a list of them. Whenever you report something from your phone, we made it as simple as possible to take a picture, send it up, and then it goes on to verifiers. If we don't have a verifier in that area, we go track someone down and say, hey, you'd like to work on this, wouldn't you? What comes out of that are things like the county level maps that you saw, that there were two shown earlier, one for the number of records that have been reported. One was just the occurrence map, but we do other stuff to do, well, what's the last time that was reported at that location? Because just because it was reported 20 years ago doesn't mean the population established, doesn't mean you've gotten current reports. So we start providing different perspectives on that data to help better understand what you're looking at. Just the basic occurrence map, it's nice to give you an overall, but it gets misinterpreted so many times, so we try to give some of that rationale into it. EdMaps also works to aggregate data from other sources. So we pull in literature, we pull in other databases. If you have data and you're going, hey, that map's wrong, we can fix that. Let's get the data in, make sure everyone has credit for their contribution for that data, because that goes to the quality of the data, the provenance of it, making sure everyone, when they see something, goes, oh, why is that colored in? Oh, that's because so-and-so said it, and here's actually the lab test that came back and said, yes, it was that. It really helps provide perspective for people to have the information they need to inform management. I'd love to have some more of the herbarium stuff to be able to address the points you're talking about and saying, look, you've got records going back to 1800s. Maybe this is kind of a perennial issue and doesn't need to be on your top 10 gonna kill me list. Yeah. We have a person whose only job is to look at data, bring it to standard, and get in the system. And then if you want data, you can download all of it that's been made available. There's 4 million records currently in the system. You can get CSVs, shape files, pull it directly into R scripts and use it in Python. However, we want the data to be used. If it just sits in our database and makes pretty maps, it's kind of a waste. It really needs to be used to inform management. So that's the quick overview of, there's lots of stuff.
Thank you. That was very informative. Well, I hope everybody got a lot out of this workshop. We really did want it to be interactive, so I thank you for participating.